Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Marilyn Berger, and she's speaking on the Inquiring Minds lecture series, Literary and Cultural Images of Women as Reflected in Law. Let's listen in on Marilyn.
I'm very pleased to be with you tonight. I have to roll the tape. So, roll the tape. My name is Marilyn Berger, and the title of this session is Literary and Cultural Images of Women as Reflected in Law. And for about the next 40 minutes, I'd like to, through nursery rhymes, short stories, fairy tales, and pieces of classical literature, I'd like to show you how, how women images have been shaped and molded by literature and how they are actually reflected in the legal system. Unfortunately, sticks and stones will break my bones and images will also harm me. They are not images. Images have a lasting effect on people. So that is what I want to present to you of how women's history has really been shaped by these images. And what we'll be doing is taking a look at, as I said, some classical pieces of literature, and we'll also be going back in history. And one of the favorite expressions of mine is, "Frailty, thy name is woman," is a quote from Shakespeare's Hamlet. And that quote has actually shaped how people have looked at women, and we see that reflected, for example, in labor laws. But it's not only classical literature, which has, of course, changed through time, but writers such as Charlotte Bronte, feminist writers, and Agatha Christie, who with Miss Marple gives us the little old frail lady who is a detective. So these literary images have had a major impact on how women are treated in the law. We can see this reflected in labor laws, in rape laws, pornography, prostitution, domestic violence, and in custody statutes. Abigail Adams, in a letter 219 years ago, wrote to her husband when he was in the Continental Congress shaping the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And she said to him, "John, in the new code of laws, you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands, because they will become tyrants." And Mr. John Adams, a few months later, got around to answering his wife's letter, and he responded, "Abigail, as to your extraordinary code of laws, I cannot but laugh." Well, what happens if we look back in time to the shaping of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? Would that have made a difference for women? Would we have been reflected more in what our needs are? And that's what I'm looking at today. I've taken three images amongst many images to talk about that we see reflected in literature. The first is women as frail, delicate, and nurturing, women as subdued, tame, battered, and beaten, and women as evil. Let's begin with this first image. You could probably all sing along, although this is not listed as a sing-along. Okay, what are little boys made of? What are little boys made of? Snaps and snails and puppy dogs' tails. That's what little boys are made of. What are little girls made of? Spice and everything nice. And that's what little girls are made of. So we even know the rhyme as to how little girls are supposed to act better than we do for little boys. Okay, what does this have to do with modern law? Well, it has everything to do, because what we see is that from the very time that we are little girls, we are taught to be obedient, kind, polite, nice, delicate, nurturing, and that we're fit for domesticity and marriage. And even though women now have careers, this set of values still clings to women and has a lasting effect. In a four-year study of pre-adolescent girls that was done by a Harvard psychologist, they found that as little girls grew up, and they studied girls from the age of 8 through adolescence, they found that as the girls grew up, they became more and more silent if they found that they were not going to be polite and nice. In other words, there was an image that they had to fulfill, a normative model. And this normative model has been passed down from generation to generation, that society expects little girls to grow up and be very nice. Now, there's nothing wrong with being very nice, but it's got its implications in what it has kept women from being able to do. For example, little girls are told that we'll be patient and wait for our prince, even if we're Cinderella's, because if you're obedient, kind, and polite, even though you are Cinderella, along will come your prince, and you'll be happy, you'll live happily ever after. Snow White is expected to be kind and nice to her murderous, wicked stepmother, which is another image, of course, that all stepmothers are wicked and evil, and that she is going to be taken away from the dwarfs because this will be a better life with her prince. Nursery rhymes tell little girls that they're going to wait for marriage. Bobby Shafto's gone to sea with silver buckles on his knee. He'll come back and marry me, pretty Bobby Shafto. But it's not just these nursery rhymes that we see that does this, but we also see this, for example, in Victorian literature that are even written by some of the authors that we think are really some of the best. For example, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. Jane Eyre is a blissful Victorian fairy tale when we look at it. She was an orphan as a young girl, struggled mightily to get her education, and she fought off all these offers of marriage from cousins and so on because she wanted to earn her own living. She eventually becomes a governess in Mr. Rochester's house, and in the end, what does Charlotte Bronte do for us? But she tells us, "Reader, I married him. A quiet wedding we had. I have been married to Mr. Rochester this morning." So this very, very forceful person who is going to actually break out of the mold winds up seeking her happiness from her prince, who is the man who employed her. And then she goes as far as to say what happens to her with all this education. She says, "No woman was ever nearer to her mate than I am. Evermore, absolutely bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh," which Charlotte Bronte, of course, has taken from Genesis. But Jane, for Mr. Rochester, is my Jane, my fairy, my skylark. So instead of having this very independent woman who has struggled mightily for an education, we're left with Jane, who is merely a fairy. But it's not only Victorian literature that's done that. We have American authors, also women authors, Willa Cather. And Willa Cather would not have won a Pulitzer Prize if she did not make her pioneer women equally vulnerable to just being available for marriage. Alexandrian, O Pioneers, has to get married to become fulfilled, and Antonia in My Antonia has to become married to find her happiness and her path in life. These images bombard women. And we see this still in magazines that teens read, that they should be only interested in making themselves more glamorous so they'll become more available. As they get older, they're told that this is the image that they should have, that their happiness will be only as useful as it gained only through a man. And then women are told that they shouldn't even bother trying to get the same interest as men because while football is on, the CBS will be running romance novels on television. So where does this all wind up? How is this actually reflected in law? We see this reflected in the professions that women could pursue, in the professional licenses that they were able to get, in the hours that they could work, and in the wage structure. Myra Bradwell, 120 years ago, tried to gain admission to the Illinois bar. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, in denying her application to be a member of the legal profession, said the natural and proper timidity and delicacy which belongs to the female sex evidently unfits it for many of the occupations of civil life. As in the nature of things, the domestic sphere properly belongs to the domain and functions of womanhood. And this is from the United States Supreme Court. You could say, well, that's pretty old. We really don't really believe that. Yet we still have these fairy tales, along with old Supreme Court cases. Snow White, of course, we're told, absolutely loves to do housework for 7 grown dwarfs. She loves to cook and clean and do the laundry. And these images are still being played out by Walt Disney. Now, women did escape from the home. Most of us did. And when they first escaped, their garden was the place that they escaped to. Nevertheless, women did escape, and when they did leave the house, there was the feeling that they had to be protected because we're very timid, frail, obedient, kind people, and our place in life is motherhood. So the first labor laws that were passed were protectionist labor laws for women. And they limited the number of hours that a woman can work to 10 hours. Now, most of us would say, gee, that sounds pretty good now. I wish that I had that. Louis Brandeis argued the case to the United States Supreme Court. And in his brief, he said the following. And the Supreme Court then adopted his very language. The physical well-being of women becomes an object of public interest and care in order to preserve the strength and vigor of the race. So in other words, what he was arguing is not equal protection for women, but that the reason we had to be protected from working such long hours is because it would imperil our child raising, and we would not give birth to healthy offspring. And it's very clear that that was the case, that it was just an interest in preserving motherhood, because in 1923, another woman applied to have the minimum wage applied to her, instead of because she was getting a much lower wage than men. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, women don't need minimum wage. They could stay at home. And it was not until 1937 that actually a minimum wage was enforced for women. This also affected women in professions. In 1924, the U.S. Supreme Court said women could not work in certain professions. And they forbid, all the way through 1971, women working as, I wouldn't want this job, but some women did, as barmaids. And it was not until 1971 that the U.S. Supreme Court said, quote, the pedestal upon which women have been placed has all too often, upon closer inspection, been revealed as a cage. Now, this has not all gone away, because even though we are allowed into many professions, there's an exception, which is called the Bona Fide Occupational Qualification, BFOQ for short, for the lawyers. And what that means is that women can be prohibited from working in certain areas that are, quote, may affect their health and safety, but we're not concerned about men. And this was used for a very long time to protect women from certain industries that would affect unborn children or might cause the women to be sterile. They were not allowed in many jobs that would be heavy lifting. They were allowed to be female flight attendants because pillows and blankets are very lightweight, and they could lift those and put them up on the shelf. Not until 1970 did the United States Supreme Court outlaw exempting women from jury service. In other words, women would automatically be exempt from jury service in, for example, New York and California and in Louisiana. Well, what does this have to do with the current state of affairs? Because we are in the workplace. Well, remember that image that I told you about of being kind, nice, polite, and appropriate. This affects how we're supposed to act and what we're supposed to wear in the workplace. There is an idealized, perfect, modern woman, the professional woman. And this idealized model has affected how women are treated in the workplace and, in fact, how they actually do their jobs. And we can see this, for example, in a very recent person. It shouldn't go without our notice, which is Marcia Clark. She was told that her hair was not appropriate, her clothes were not appropriate, because there was an idealized model for a professional woman lawyer. And they said, you are not making it. And so she was made over, not once, not twice, but three times until she, quote, got it right. And now all the commentators are saying nice things about her clothing and her hair. And this all stems from all these nursery rhymes and fairy tales and classical literature of what the idealized woman should be, that there's a proper role model. In a recent case, a 1989 case, that I think is one of the most egregious cases that I have read, it concerns a woman by the name of Ann Hopkins, who was a senior manager in an office of Price Waterhouse, which is an accounting firm, and she was in their head office. And there were 662 partners in Price Waterhouse. Seven of those partners were women in 1989. In the class of people that she entered, of the associates who would then be eventually tracked for partnership, there were 88 people. And out of the 88, only one of them was a woman, who was Ann Hopkins. And all through her tenure, which was a 7-year period, she got outstanding work evaluations, and she was told that she was a top-notch performer. But unknown to her at the time, there were certain rumblings. Well, she came up for partnership. She was denied partnership and told that she was not eligible because her work was not up to standards. She didn't know what it was, so she figured that they were discriminated against her because she was the only woman in the group of 88. All the 88 men got to be partners. 87 got to be partners, and Ann Hopkins was not promoted. So she went to court. And when she was being examined, when the partners were being examined in a deposition before trial, she found out the reasons, because the partners came forward and they said, Ann is, quote, overly aggressive and unduly harsh. One partner described her as macho. Another partner suggested she overcompensated for being a woman. A third partner advised her to take a course at charm school. When they were trying to get her to withdraw her lawsuit and settle the case, the final blow came from her mentor, a male partner at the office, who said, kindly advised to her, Hopkins, you should, quote, walk more femininely, talk more femininely, dress more femininely, wear makeup, have your hairstyle, and wear jewelry. Well, Anne didn't withdraw her lawsuit, and after 10 years of litigation and $439,000 in attorney's fees, she won after 5 court cases, which went up and down to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, that only happens to roughly 5% of the women who suffer sex discrimination or sexual harassment on the job actually wind up bringing any kinds of charges. And why is this? Because women have this image of being kind and polite and will take a back seat and not stir up trouble. Maybe it's true that we should welcome Louis Brandeis back and say, gee, I'd welcome not being on my feet for 16 hours a day and being the supermom, because that is in effect what many women are doing today. Yet the supermom, even when you perform up to speed in your job and at home, has difficulties. And we see this reflected in the law. There are many cases, but I've taken just one of these cases, a custody fight in Washington, D.C., where the woman was the lead counsel for Orrin Hatch. And her husband said that she was putting their child in daycare too much and taking her job too seriously, and he was willing to stay at home and take care of their child, and so she lost custody, and it's now a battle in court. So in summary, what we could see is that these images of women being polite, kind, nurturing, and fit to domesticity have had an adverse impact in labor law, in child custody, and as you can see, in women and how they should behave in the workplace, and what happens to them when they take a different role than what is expected, the case of Anne Hopkins. Okay, let's go on and take a look at women subdued, tamed, battered, and beaten. In this section, I want to explore the image of women as property and how that image is now reflected in our domestic, domestic relations laws, and also in how it affects battered women. The right of man to control his wife is an image that's embedded in the law. Historically, women were property, property of their fathers and then property of their husbands. The whole idea of a dowry and giving away women in marriage is from that concept that women were owned. They were a piece of chattel. A husband had a legal right to beat his wife as long as he did not use an instrument that was bigger than the width of his thumb. And that comes from the laws of England. I actually saw that when I was at the British Museum. So it, in fact, did once upon a time exist. This whole idea of women as property, we can see, even from the Bible, of looking at Eve as a piece of Adam's rib. We can see this in nursery rhymes, innocent nursery rhymes. Peter, Peter, pumpkin eater had a wife and couldn't keep her. He put her in a pumpkin shell, and there he kept her very well. Total control. Lock her up, and you are in control of this woman. This is a very innocent nursery rhyme that has very, very severe implications for women, because it shows that Peter, Peter, pumpkin eater's wife was once the property of her father and now the property of her husband to be controlled in a way that is not very nice. The worst incidents of control of women as property, of course, were the slave women. Enslaved women were total chattel to be bought and sold, and their children as well. This is an excerpt from an autobiography by a slave woman written in 1861 in her own writing. And she's reflecting on how slaves looked at New Year's Eve. To the slave mother, New Year's Day comes laden with peculiar sorrows. She sits on her cold cabin floor, watching the children who may be all torn from her the next morning. And often does she wish that she and they might die before the day dawns. She may be an ignorant creature, degraded by the system that has brutalized her from childhood, but she has a mother's instincts and is capable of feeling mother's agonies. On one of these sale days, I saw a mother lead 7 children to the auction block. She knew that some of them would be taken from her, but they took all. The idea of controlling women was looked at as a comedy by Shakespeare in The Taming of the Shrew, written in 1594. Now we can say, well, maybe this is just a chauvinistic plot, but I think it has significance because it's still performed today and it's still looked at as a comedy. And just to refresh some of us that haven't read Shakespeare in the last 100 years, Kate was a fiercely independent woman whom Shakespeare dubs the Shrew. And she had a younger sister, Bianca. Bianca was beautiful and wooed by lots of suitors. And Bianca, though, could not get married until the older sister, Kate, got married. That was the kind of rule at the time. And the father wanted Kate very much to get married, but Kate was a very independent, fierce woman, and nobody wanted to marry her. So the father puts up this huge dowry, and along comes Petruchio, a very destitute young man who is in search of wealth and arranges with Kate's father for getting the substantial dowry if he agrees to marry Kate. And he then says, and on top of it, I come to wive it wealthily in Padua, if wealthily, then happily in Padua. And he then sets about, because he doesn't want to be married to this shrew woman, to tame her. And he says, for I am he and born to tame you, Kate. And Petruchio succeeds in breaking Catherine's spirit and will. He does this by depriving her of food and sleep. And Kate is wandering around in circles, delirious from lack of sleep and food. And she's asking, why did he marry me? To famish me? To starve me? I'm giddy for lack of sleep. Does he do it under the name of perfect love? But at last, Kate is broken, bridled like a horse. And Petruchio then wants to show off what he's done, because it seems that the other young ladies in the kingdom are also acting pretty uppity. And so he wants to show them that they too can be tamed just like he tamed Kate. So he brings Kate out for her final scene. And she says to these other young maidens and lords who are gathered, thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee, and for thy maintenance commits his body to painful labor both by sea and land. Whilst thou liest warm at home, secure and safe, and craves no other tribute at thy hands but love, fair looks, and true obedience, too little payment for so great a debt, and place your hands below your husband's foot, in token of which duty, if you please, my hand is ready, may it do him ease. And of course we know the last line, why there's a wench, come on and kiss me, Kate. And that's the end of Taming of the Shrew. The horrific part of this humiliating comedy is that recognizing that poor Kate, if she lived today, would have been a battered, broken woman. She, during various stages of development of how women are controlled, she either would have gotten a frontal lobotomy or electric shock treatment, sedatives like Valium, and today Prozac and its companions, all to make her happy and accepting what her fate is in life. Petruchio subdued and controlled Kate by dominating her. It was his right according to the law at the time. And that was reflected in England. But we can see this right still carried forth in Peter Pumpkin Eater. Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew is still performed without any changes, although I don't believe in censorship. And what this does is lay a stage that we have readily accepted the battering of women in the world. What we see is that this is the greatest cause of injury to women. On Super Bowl Sunday, a woman is beaten once every 15 seconds. Why? Because of a lot of alcohol and aggression that comes from those types of games. The 1990 FBI Uniform Crimes Report estimates there are 1.5 million to 3 million domestic beatings a year. And the FBI estimates that that is only 10% of the cases that are reported. 4 women are killed every day by their husbands or boyfriends. And the whole part of this is to take a look at how these images from history are really reflected in how women are treated and have been treated up to the present time. There was a total lack of enforcement for battered women. It was treated as a family matter. And now, even though it is a mandatory situation that in the state of Washington, if a woman calls or there's a report of a battered woman, there's automatic arrest. And the man is hauled off to jail. But what does that mean? It means that the person can then be bailed out as soon as 20 minutes later. Few convictions still result. 1994 case, October 18th, a man who killed his wife in Baltimore, Maryland, received 18 months in jail. This is a direct quote from the judge. I seriously wonder how many married men married 5-4 years would have had the strength to walk away without inflicting some corporal punishment. I'm forced to impose a sentence only because I think I must do it to make the system honest. And that's from a judge facing a man who, in fact, just had murdered his wife. When women fight back, it's a stereotype, because when they fight back, they then have to use this thing called the battered woman syndrome, which usually does not work. One more image from this time. This used to be my favorite book. I've ruined a lot of literature for myself. Scarlet and Red. Women grow up and carry around powerful romantic images. Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara and Clark Gable, who played Rhett Butler from Gone with the Wind. Was it possible that Scarlett was raped by the virile, hero, handsome Rhett Butler? The dashing and handsome Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind? This is a direct quote from the book, taken out of context. Forcibly, he carried Scarlett. He swung her off her feet into his arms and started up the stairs. Her head was crushed against his chest, and she heard the hard hammering of his heart beneath her ears. He hurt her, and she cried out, muffled, frightened. Up the stairs he went in the utter darkness, up, up, and she was wild with fear. He was a mad stranger, and this was a black darkness she did not know, darker than death. He was like death, carrying her away in arms that hurt. And that is literature. This is then reflected in the rape statutes that we have, both marital rape statutes and regular rape statutes. Marital rape is still condoned in 32 states in this country, that a man can legally rape his wife if she is still his wife, even if he is legally separated. And in California, marital rape can be tried as a misdemeanor, although the rape is normally a felony crime, and a small fine with less than a year in jail is imposed. Why this state of affairs? I think we can reflect back to the image of women as property, and that this is perfectly legitimate when somebody belongs to you. We want to go on to the third and last image, which is women as evil, sexually seductive, and chattel. In this section, the image is embedded in the law concerning rape, prostitution, and pornography. A predominant image of women represented over time in literature is that of evil temptress. That women are sexually taunting objects is a strikingly familiar refrain, luring, seducing, and teasing men. Eve in the apple orchard, the first seducer, the first betrayer, the first seductress. Women are looked at as luring ladies. They become the symbol for the evils of all mankind. Magic Johnson, when he was justifying and bragging about his sexual conquest, differentiated between women as floozies on the one type and women who were good. This image of floozies versus good, we can see reflected in religion, and we can see it reflected in everyday life. Eve would be a floozy in some people's eyes, and the Madonna, not Madonna who sings, Madonna, as a good girl. We can see this reflected in rape laws. Women are still blamed for being raped. The focus in rape laws is on the victim. There is no other crime where we focus on the victim to see whether the victim did something that could tempt or control the situation. For example, if I was walking down the street and one of you decided to punch me in the mouth, you wouldn't reflect on, did I smile too grandly at you? Did I do something to make you do that? No, you would be prosecuted for assault and battery. Yet, in rape, we focus on the victim's own state of mind, of whether or not she consented to this activity. We also, in recent times, have said that the victim's prior sexual activity should not be part of the trial. Yet, invariably, there are all kinds of ways that that information is put forth to juries. There are exceptions to that rule, and you can see that in the famous Smith case where Mr. Smith got off for the rape of that woman down in Florida. The physical surroundings of the rape become relevant, the physical resistance of the rape become relevant, the contributory behavior is relevant, and when and how it's reported to the authorities. This is the only crime, and it's a crime that is basically against women, that you have this standard. The last thing I want to talk about is women as chattels, as body pieces. The image of women as evil is embedded in the prostitution statutes. Women are tramps and evil to be used. The sexual objectification of women can be seen and is exacerbated by the Playboy bunny, the Barbie doll, which is not a real woman. And we can see this when we constantly juxtapose good women and bad women. And you always see this in movies and television. There's always a good person and a bad person. Prostitution is illegal in all states except Nevada. But a truism is that mostly women are arrested for this crime. In the Florida Supreme Court Gender and Bias Study Commission in 1990, the standard profile of the offender for prostitution was a man who pays for the service of a prostitute who is white, middle class, and married. The enforcement is rarely against men, and when it is, it becomes front page news in every newspaper and headlines in on television that the city council has decided to now enforce the rules on the statutes against prostitution against men and women. In 1985, the year of a study that was done, police in Boston, Cleveland, and Houston arrested twice as many people, men, women for prostitution as they did for all homicides, rapes, robberies, assaults combined. Okay, you can ask, well, why do they do that? It's obviously income producing. That is not the case at all. The average fine that's collected from a prostitute is under $100. One other thing that is noted for the reason why police departments go ahead and enforce prostitution statutes against women is because the police engage usually in the arrest by using the decoy method, and it's less dangerous, and police have said, quote, it's actually much nicer work. We prefer this type of employment because we get newly leased cars, we've got clothes, and we get to look like guys with money to burn. So it's a preferred arrest beat. Is it possible that many of the vice officers really do enjoy the time spent around women in massage parlors, modeling studios, and the like? Is prostitution really a victimless crime? It's analogous to institutionalized rape. It's a crime against women and children, and it's an economic enterprise. A prostitute cannot be raped under the law, for example. The image of women as evil permeates and ties together prostitution and pornography laws as well. There is no other place that I know of where there is a constitutional amendment that protects pain and mutilation and objectification of anybody except the First Amendment when you're talking about pornography. In this area, it's perfectly legitimate for the sake of social redeeming value that women can be raped, tied up, bruised, mutilated, and penetrated by animals. In every large metropolitan area in the United States, there are businesses, as we all know, where women are presented as sexual objects and to be objectified and voyeured. Most cities do not offer businesses where one can pay and go to see a person being brutalized if they're a Jew, if they're an Arab, if they're a Lutheran, Chinese, African American, Native American, or a physically challenged person. We only do this when it is a woman, and it's perfectly legitimate and it goes on every day. What is the redeeming social value of pornography? And if you recall from the very beginning, when I asked you what would be the difference if Abigail Adams had been part of the drafting party, if some of us had the sensibilities of Abigail Adams, would we have looked at the First Amendment the same way when it comes to pornography? Would we be having those kinds of fights? Well, where does this all lead us? It sounds very dismal, and this is a terrible lecture to give for a Saturday night in a park and serene atmosphere. Well, the first thing is women would be treated differently, but I think we have to start looking at new images. There should be heroines that we all applaud. For example, Joan of Arc should be a military heroine and not a crazed lunatic burned at the stake. Eve should be looked at as the mother of the human race. Eleanor Roosevelt should be looked at as a great statesperson and not a woman who actually just buried her sorrows because Franklin was having an affair with somebody else and she turned to politics to get her happiness. Susan B. Anthony could be a national heroine. Do you realize that no holiday honors a woman except Mother's Day? There is not one single holiday except Mother's Day that honors a woman. Look at your coins. How many women appear on the face of a coin? With new images, the possibility that the Bill of Rights would be interpreted to protect women is possible. It's an irony, isn't it, that a woman is the symbol for justice. In one hand, she holds the scales of justice, but in the other hand, she holds a sword. And if Abigail had been alive today, she'd tell her husband, "Arbitrary powers, like most other things, John, which are very hard, very liable to be broken. We have it in our power not only to free ourselves, but to subdue our masters and without violence throw both your natural and legal authority at your feet." Fini. Okay, comments? And by the way, this is supposed to be provocative, so you don't have to agree with what I said. This is for discussion purposes.
So let's take the First Amendment pornography as an example. Would your point be that the amendment is blind, but the let me pose a counterexample. Take the case, for instance, of male on male explicit pornography. Is your point that the culture itself causes the bias, and the amendment or law, whatever, prosecution, enforcement aside, is straight? I don't think you're saying that there should be a special clause, say in the First Amendment, saying there should not be pornography against women.
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
No, but what I am saying is that is the only amendment that directly protects the brutalization of women. And I think that because it's an economic enterprise and billions of dollars are spent, billions, not millions, billions of dollars are spent on pornography, all the way from electronic now to books and movies, etc. If those people who are reaping the benefit did not reap the benefit or had to pay for that benefit as a harm to women, then I think that you would see tremendous changes in society. But they are allowed through a constitutional protection to make their billions. And there's no tax on them, for example. And yet there's a tremendous harm to women. And there's a direct correlation, according to many social scientists who have studied it, and there are people on the opposite side who said that there is no correlation, that violence against women and crimes against women and children are directly reflected from pornography. And it's free. They can do it. There's no tax on them.
nor is there attacks on male against male violence.
That's true. Yeah. Yes.
I was curious that if the Bible presents Eve as the seducer and as the one who caused the fall of the world, what is the Christian church in America or around the world doing to elevate women and change that image?
Well, I'll throw that back to the audience.
I would like to say something about that. I think that when we read that story, we also have to remember that the other person in that story refused to take any responsibility for his actions. Mm-hmm. And that to read that as solely a woman tempting a man to do something is really putting the blame on one side without recognizing that the man did his share and not even accepting responsibility for his own actions.
I'd like to continue. I hear your opinion, but I'm still asking the question. As an institution, can anybody tell me
what, say your
as
question.
An institution, what's the church doing?
Start teaching children.
How are they doing that?
I do.
I guess I'm asking the question because we have pastors, we have church councils, we have all these things, and I'm just curious if that, as the movement was being started.
Well, when those movements start, they're derided as liberal feminist, feminazi, quote, whatever that means, and part of the evil liberal establishment by many churches. And even the Pope's recent statement, which I understand is very, uses a lot of feminist language, still in the end excludes women. One thing that Holden might, well, I can't speak for Holden, but one thing that that Holden lifts up is the whole idea of expansive language for God, where you talk about God as not only a man, but also God as other things, a nurturing mother, that female images for God play a huge role, can play a huge role in altering the way that people look at women, because God is no longer just a man, God is also a woman.
Does that answer your question? I don't think it does.
No,
does
I'm it? Listening to that, and okay. I appreciate your comment.
I'm it's just a good comment.
That many churches, Christian churches, have made an effort as an institution to say the Jews themselves were not responsible for the crucifixion of Christ. All humanity was. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes.
Okay. They have made a strong statement as an institution, a Christian organization, saying it wasn't just the Jews, it was all humanity responsible for Christ's death. I was just trying to find out in a very gentle way, was this also being done for women? And I'm not hearing that it has.
I don't think it's being done.
Just curious.
I think that, as in many cases, it's those issues are, they tend to stay at the bottom of the barrel. Somebody made the comment about being labeled feminazi and things like that, and I think that that's very true. I think there are people who are doing that, individuals in small groups, but I don't think as an institution we've made much progress at all. There's many Sunday schools where the story of Adam and Eve is taught literally, and Eve is the bad one, and other such messages.
Yes?
I'm not sure from the discussion, but you can be a Christian, believe in the Bible, and not beat your wife. You can have a good marriage and live by the Bible. The Bible cannot be blamed for what you're talking about.
I didn't blame it. What I was presenting is various images when you look at the sum total allow a license to look at women a certain way. And of course people, I mean, I wouldn't expect that anybody here is reflecting those viewpoints. But yet, when you add them up, it's a very subliminal message for many people who take that message and don't look at it. I mean, why are there so many battered women then? Why was it allowed for so long and is still being allowed?
An example in today's paper that you're probably aware of, being from the Tacoma area, is showing the response of Ivan with the female apes. This hit front page, and people are talking about, well, that's the male-female relationship. You didn't see that?
No, I didn't see today's paper.
It was a front page.
Not exactly.
Certainly. Certainly.
Yes.
The pattern of male being dominant goes back to the very beginning of human history. Mm-hmm. It's recorded in effect, as you indicate, in the Bible. It's apparently the nature of male to be dominant, that part of his nature. You were talking about law. The answer is not law. The answer is in the mind of people, the mind of man, if you will. And laws are needed to help. Laws are needed to protect. But laws will not cure the situation. I don't think.
You're right. Does anybody want to comment on that comment?
I think this will help clarify for me. As I understand your thesis tonight, it wasn't necessarily that a particular law should be changed. It would be that there's this huge cultural inertia that is wrapped up into the way the law is applied, and we should maintain a visibility and awareness of this cultural inertia, to use the word, causes uneven application of the law. And that is really the issue, is the way the inertia affects the application of existing laws as opposed to drafting a new set of laws.
Well, the whole interpretation of written history was not written by women. It was written by men. And the Bible was not written by women, it was written by men. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about all these things that reflects women and men a certain way, it is a one point of view. And that's why I brought up Abigail Adams, that women were not part of the drafting of the United States Constitution. They had absolutely no input. The only person who possibly could have had input was Abigail Adams. And look at how she was treated by her own husband, who actually thought that her ideas, some of them were quite good, and then he wound up ridiculing them in the end and not using any of them. But what I'm saying is that when you have a history that has been written by and for a certain segment of society, and then the images that you're constantly looking at in literature and culture reflect that, you have to start wondering whether there's another way of looking at things. And you're right, law will not change things. It's in people's minds. But these things are embedded in our minds because we go around not even seeing it. We don't even look at the nursery rhymes that we read kids. We don't look at the fairy tales that we read to children. And that has a message that constantly gets out. It's a bombardment that so you have this dichotomy of women are supposed to be equal and independent, yet you've got this whole other culture that contradicts it. That's all I'm saying. I don't know the answer to it. I'm just pointing out my interpretation.
Yeah, and I agree with what you presented. That's the situation.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out why it ever started in the first place. Is it because male is way back is physically stronger and was able to dominate because of this physical superior strength, maybe?
Well, that's a good question. Are you going to respond to the question?
Something
okay.
I was reading this year took the viewpoint that women became dependent because they were the childbearers, and they could not go out and do the hunting while they were 9 months pregnant or had a newborn strapped to them. That they just ended up staying at home taking care of the children, and the men were able to go out and do the hunting and the growing. And that's how women ended up being.
Well, and then what happened is that history then puts a value on that job. In other words, if we value that job, that women would not be in the position that they are now. For example, if raising children was a primary position that human beings had in life, then they would be paid for that or valued for that, as opposed to putting the status and the value and the importance on men going outside and earning a living. And that's all written because women weren't part of that entourage writing what was good and what was not good and what was valued. I mean, I could foresee, for example, if women were part of the drafting of the United States Constitution, I would have put in there an amendment saying that every household, if somebody wants to stay home taking care of the children, that there's a fee attached to that or some, you know, some protection, in other words, and that after that's done, that you would earn certain credits in life. I mean, right now, if a woman stays home and takes care of children by choice and thinks that's a very important job, she doesn't get Social Security credit. If the man walks out on her, that's it. She's got nothing. She has absolutely nothing. She has to track him down when he gets ready to retire to get part of that Social Security.
May yeah. I respond to the gentleman's comment?
Yes.
It's my understanding that actually, before written history, human society was matriarchal, and that that women, in fact, did run human society, and there are some evidences in ancient mythological writings for women being the heads of societies, and that sometime around the beginning of recorded history, that may have changed. And it's been suggested to me that the reason had to do with rather radical changes in the environment that for some reason allowed for the change of roles. So it's not necessarily true that men have always been dominant, or it is somehow in their nature to be the dominant gender. Mm-hmm.
Well, you're right in terms of the first deities were goddesses, and they were all women. And one historian, Gerda Lerner, who some of you may have heard of, who has written a lot in this field, has said that actually the change of dominance, where men became dominant and women became subordinate, was because the value of women was then recognized because they could produce so many heirs, and it became a more sedentary state instead of just a hunter-gatherer state. So it's tied to her. Right. It's tied to the beginning of civilization when you could see the accrual of wealth by getting large families to perhaps do farming or gather more wealth for one's family. That's one theory.
You mentioned Abigail Adams. There have been many queens throughout history. Is there any record that they have tried to establish rights for women?
No. I mean, we had a woman prime minister in England.
Yes.
And she never employed a single woman in her cabinet. Not one. Not one of her ministers was a woman. I don't know what that says, but...
Well, I think it speaks to that women are susceptible to the dominant power system.
Yes, right.
And that in order to survive in it, you